Justice for All People. Learn more at ajws.org. Here's Nicole Wagner to open this hour of Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio. Austin-based singer-songwriter Nicole Wagner for you here on KPR's Trail Mix. Her song called Beauty Where You Find It is from her album out this summer called Plastic Flowers. Nicole Wagner. I'm Bob McWilliams. Thanks for joining me on Trail Mix. A lot more music until right before 4 when we'll have Stardate at 4 o'clock, of course, all things considered. In about 6 minutes, we're going to travel back to 1998 for the first album from the great duo Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer. Some songs from that. Some songs from the current duo, Crow and Gazelle, right now. The album is called As Above Now, So Below. Here are Crow and Gazelle on Trail Mix.
First time I saw you, we're deep in a hollow, surrounded by a sea of fallen trees. Down from the sun you came shining, and you lighted me with a feather, woven with words that made me believe. Blackbird, beside you, before you came, better than before you came. Shining as above now, so below, as above now, so below, as above now, so below. That was nothing but a hound in the alley, a wild beast on a long leash. You were water ripping through a dry valley. You were the sun shining in the east. These are the days that I thought would never come around. Just had to wait for our paths to cross somehow. The past didn't matter much now anyway. Now that these are the days, these are the days. Slow myself down, deep breath in and a long look around. If there's something inside me that I found that needs to change, I can change. If it needs to change, I can change. These are the days I thought would never come around. Just had to wait. I passed across somehow. The past didn't matter much now anyway. Now that these are the days, these are the days, yeah, yeah. These are the days. Now that these are the days, these are the days, yeah, yeah. These are the days.
The duo Crow and Gazelle on KPR with the song These Are the Days, and before that, the song Blackbird. Their new album this year is called As Above, Now So Below. Crow and Gazelle with music from the debut album of the duo of Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer. Next here on Trail Mix, in a little under 15 minutes, we'll debut a new live album from Steep Canyon Rangers here on KPR. Support for Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio comes from I2S at KU, creating, disseminating, and commercializing fundamental knowledge and new technologies in computer systems, communication systems, and radar systems. More at i2s-research.ku.edu. Well, back in 1998 at the Folk Alliance Conference in Albuquerque, might have been 99, I went to see this duo that I'd never heard of at a showcase. Not a lot of people were there. Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer, and they did these two songs I'm going to play for you from their debut album, When I Go. And I went to every one of the showcases over the next several days, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Really special. Here's Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer with Annie's Lover on KPR.
Annie's lover was a medicine man, and he roamed the chokes and boulders. Hickory staddle in his big black hand, and a star upon his shoulder. He'd go down to the meadow at night. He would dance in the firefly light, and she would dream like a pagan queen when he'd hold her. Annie's lover was a wildcat's brother and the badger's mad companion. In his rainbow beads and his straw hat, he was the king of Mercy Canyon. In the winter, she would trade her crown for boots of buckskin leather, rise up singing when the sun went down, and ride out on the heather. They would meet in the meadow at night. They would dance in the fey moonlight, dip and spin and skate the wind like feathers. 'Cause Annie's lover was a wildcat's brother and the badger's mad companion. In his rainbow beads and his straw hat, he was the king of Mercy Canyon. Twilight hills out past the gates of Eden, graze your pony where the dark spring spills, and surely you will see them. They come down to the meadow at night. There they dance till the morning light, and all the bounding saints run round to greet them. 'Cause Annie's lover was a wildcat's brother and the badger's mad companion. In his rainbow beads and his straw hat, he was the king of Mercy Canyon. He was the king of Mercy Canyon. Walking, talking, breathing, new age wonder, old time heathens don't know what to make of Mary Jane. 'Cause she ain't trying to be no swami, she ain't mad at dad and mommy, she don't curse the storm clouds when it rains. When the sun refused to shine, she don't mind, she make everything look fine. She got moon in her eyes, crescent windows on the skies, and the rain comes down in sheets on the people in the streets. And it carries all the secrets that they keep to the river where she sleeps. She comes to me when I'm dejected, leaves her soul out unprotected, tells me that the truth can make me free. And she don't need what she ain't got, she reads me books by Alan Watts, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. When the sun refused to shine, she don't mind, she take thunder for a sign. She got stars in her head, supernovas in her bed, and it rains most every day, but I like it fine that way. 'Cause the waters run so marvelous and deep in the river where she sleeps. Drinking, still she stumbles without thinking anywhere. She gets the urge to stray. And everybody knows about her. They don't want to change or doubt her. They just grin when she comes out to play. When the sun refused to shine, she don't mind. She be moving down the line. She got bells on her toes, generations in her clothes. And she sings without a sound as the evening rolls around. And she dances as the twilight shadows creep down the river where she sleeps. Professor, come to burst my bubble, says that girl's bound for trouble, serves me solace in a paper cup. But it looks a bit like Agent Orange, and when he leaves he slams the door, and just about that time she phones me up. When the sun refused to shine, well, she don't mind, she just ain't the worrying kind. She got dogs, she got cats, she keeps rabbits in her hats. And the people that she sees, they're all Buddhas or police. And the banks rise high and perilous and steep by the river where she sleeps. Dismayed December dawn, I wake to find my Mary's gone, and no one knows when she'll come back again. And all the silent temple bells, from Styx to Glen to Hazel Dell, are mourning all the nights that might have been. When the sun refused to shine, well, she don't mind, she just laid this world behind. She got wheels in her smiles, she can coast along for miles. Me, I'm walking all alone, feeling soulful to the bone, till I stop and I hang my head and weep by the river where she sleeps.
Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer here on KPR with Annie's Lover and the River Where She Sleeps, two Dave Carter songs from their 1998 album debut called When I Go. We would lose Dave to a heart attack just a little while later in the summer of 1992 to shy of his 50th birthday, but the music that Dave wrote and the Draven Tacy made together certainly does live on. I'm Bob McWilliams. It's Kansas Public Radio's Trail Mix with new music from the live album by the Steep Canyon Rangers just ahead here on KPR. But, you know, we're in the time of year when it's important for you to understand that while you can listen to this radio station for free, it's not free to bring you Trail Mix on KPR. Here's what you can do to support Kansas Public Radio.
Supporting Kansas Public Radio is a very easy proposition. It just takes a little bit of your money and a tiny bit of your time making a pledge over at kansaspublicradio.org or by calling us toll-free at 1-888-577-5268. Make a pledge in support of Trail Mix, one of the most unique radio programs to be found anywhere and a real gem in the crown here at Kansas Public Radio. Like the Dave Carter song says, when the sun refused to shine, she don't mind. But the sun is shining out there. We've got a beautiful day. We're all gathered together enjoying some wonderful music on a Saturday afternoon, just like we've been doing for 30 years with Trail Mix, celebrating our 30th anniversary pretty soon. It's thanks to the support of listeners that this program exists for you and is here for us all to enjoy. So be the next one to support us at kansaspublicradio.org or 888-577-5268. And it's an important time to do it because we are closing in on an important challenge that we have from Joanne Myers of Topeka, matching pledges dollar for dollar right now for the next $235 worth of pledges that we receive. So we're close to making this goal, but we need your help to make it happen and carry us over. I'm Jeff Watson with Bob McWilliams and local attorney and original supporter of Trail Mix, David J. Brown. Thanks for being here, David.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. I say it all the time. I'm happy and honored to be here and to help raise money for the station. You know, Daryl Brogdon, years ago when training me on how to do this pledge drive stuff, said, you know, you have to ask people for what you need. And he suggested that at least you should ask someone to make a pledge of $1,000. Now, I understand many people cannot afford that. But He said, if you don't ask, nobody's going to think, oh, I could contribute that amount of money. We would happily accept that kind of gift. But if you could contribute the $235 to finish this pledge challenge, or even $10 or $15 a month, whatever you can afford is what we're asking you to give. And it's really simple. You just have to call that number, 888-577-5268, or get online at kansaspublicradio.org to make the pledge. You can do it on a credit card. You can say, I'll pay you next month. There are all sorts of ways to arrange the payment. But the important thing is that you make the call or you get online and you make the pledge. We really need that support from you. We are committed to bringing this programming to you. Bob McWilliams is committed to giving you the best music he can provide. Can't you be committed to supporting him? 888-577-5268. Please, call now.
I'm so appreciative of all the people over 30 years who've donated to Kansas Public Radio to help keep this radio show on the air for 30 years. I don't think I'll be around doing this in 30 years, but want to do it as long as I can, and that's really based on as long as you support it. And we have support. We have listeners all over the country. We just got a pledge in, a new pledge from Dallas, Texas, from Walt McCool, so thank you for that. And your support, if you've already pledged, thank you. If not, take advantage of this. Knock out this challenge for $235 left in the Joe and Myers dollar-for-dollar matching gift. Have your pledge doubled right now at $120 or at $235. Do it now at kansaspublicradio.org, kansaspublicradio.org, or call 1-888-577-5268.
And one of the things that you should keep in mind is that if you've been listening to Trail Mix for a little while but have never contributed, if you're joining us as a new member this afternoon, we'll send you the KPR welcome box for new members, which is just a small little box with some surprises, some goodies, some sunglasses, some refrigerator magnets, a bumper sticker, some extra little fun items that you'll get in exchange for giving us a pledge as a new member during this fall fanfare over at Kansas.
Jeff, I should mention that's at the $10 a month level.
Correct. You're absolutely right about that. $10 a month or $120 for the year. If you're able to give us $10 a month as a new member, we'll send you along the KPR welcome box. It is, of course, at kansaspublicradio.org or toll free at 888-577-5268. We've got some more wonderful trail mix on the way in just a moment. But as Bob mentioned, we are very close to meeting the challenge from Joanne Myers of Topeka, who is matching pledges dollar for dollar right now for the next $235 worth of pledges that we get. If you're able to give at $10 a month, you'll be helping us meet this challenge. Contribute now at kansaspublicradio.org, and thanks to all of you for your support of KPR.
Those loose-limbed gals, they swing their feet down the airport side of Franklin Street. Watching them in a not quite innocent way, looking at them this evening, thinking about the plans I put on hold while the town got smaller and the days unrolled. There ain't but two stories told. This one's about leaving. I remember Katie, then Rosalie. I was pressing my luck when I tried for three. Some shrink from a shameful deed. Me, I'll do it gladly. If I hand you a line, you know that's true. If I give you a couple, it's yours to choose. One story from a total of two has got a good chance to end badly. So fare thee well, Carolina gals. I'm going where you can't find me. There'll be trouble in the days to come and a lot more fools behind me. I was just a lad about yay tall, sniffing at glue in the Northgate Mall, down where the anchor can see you all. Kindness is a show for strangers. All them B-school boys and old hippie men sweating in the sun to no clear end. I made a medium to poor boyfriend and a pretty good house painter. So fare thee well, Carolina gals. I'm going where you can't find me. There'll be trouble in the days to come and a lot more fools behind me.
dreaming the while he was laying out my downfall. So with my hair and my eyes and my chest out swelled, I stood on a porch and buzzed the bell, peeking around the blind, knowing full well that her folks was gone to Boston. And they made quiet when they say lights out, but that was love making and it made me shout. Daddy would have come home fast, no doubt, if he knew what the wicked had cost. So fare thee well, Carolina gals, I'm going where you can't find me. There'll be trouble in the days to come and a lot more gold behind me. Now if a cruel word escapes my mind, don't worry, baby, it's just the wine. Second thought, it's not the wine, it's just me talking. We men pour out our problems like we think that they're unique. We cheer when a baby starts to speak, ought to give them a prize for stopping. Mama, don't you be too surprised if I cash in the farm after Mama dies. Get a Cadillac and just ride to the Pacific, meets the bumper. Stop looking at me like I've lost a screw, like things had to lead where they led to. With the house half gone to kudzu, I'd be lucky to get a clunker. My luck, I landed in the upper south. My God, I gotta make my own. Should've read the signs by now. Should've heard the locusts buzzing. Poor old Tommy Thompson's dead and gone, and I've been feeling not so strong. Chapel Hill hadn't done me wrong. It was fine until it wasn't. So fare thee well, Carolina gals. I'm going where you can't find me. There'll be trouble in the days to come and a lot more fools. Fare thee well, Carolina gals, I'm going where you can't find me. There'll be trouble in the days to come and a lot more fools behind me.
The applause for Steep Canyon Rangers here on Kansas Public Radio. Their brand new album is called Greenfield Lake, and we heard their song, Fare Thee Well, Carolina Gals. We've got a song up next called Kentucky Blue from Nick Taylor here on KPR's Trail Mix. We're here and we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.9 Atchison. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Well, Nick Taylor, born and raised in rural southeast Texas. He's now based in Austin, Texas. He first tried to write a song at age 18, but he said he didn't finish that first song till he was 25. It took a while. He took playing gigs and getting settled into the music business, but man, he's come up with some good songs on this album. The new album called Not Alone. It's Nick Taylor and the song Kentucky Girl here on KPR.
Take my hand, sweet Kentucky girl, no you can't. 'Cause I've been standing here trying just to be your man. And a true love mesmerized. Yes, that's why I've been stuck here, falling to your eyes. in sweet Kentucky. Girl, lift me up. It's every day that I'm here with you. Can't believe I love you. It's like sun shining through a smile. For more, and I don't think I can take it.
Bass singer-songwriter Nick Taylor and the song Kentucky Girl from his debut album that came out this summer called Not Alone. He grew up in Southeast Texas, interested in music from an early age and loved early on music like Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Patsy Cline and more. Then he heard a band that got him into playing jazz in middle school and high school. He even went off to college to study jazz. He decided it wasn't for him and he dropped out of that and learned guitar. And trying to start write songs, that took a few years, but finally he got into that. And the result is this album, Not Alone, Nick Taylor on Kansas Public Radio's Trail Mix. I'm Bob McQueen. We've got more Trail Mix still to come. Brilliant young fiddler and singer, too, Bronwyn Keith Hines, who's quite busy playing in the bands of Molly Tuttle and Billy Strange. There's their new album out. And we'll hear the great guitarist, Beppe Gambetta, that and more on the way after we come to you once again for the last time today during Trail Mix and ask for your help in supporting Kansas Public Radio.
And you can support Kansas Public Radio during this fall fanfare over at kansaspublicradio.org or call us toll-free at 1-888-577-5268 and support a radio program that you won't find anywhere else. This is more than just a radio show. This is an oasis. It's a hidden paradise of music, of joy, of discovery each and every weekend. It's a place where you'll discover new artists, new music. You'll be kept up to date on the local music scene as musicians come to the area to play in the live performance studio and chat with Bob about concerts coming up in this region. It's a wonderful place for you to spend your time, and it exists for a special reason, because everybody pitches in to make this a special place. Right now, we're hoping that you can pitch in and help us meet a challenge we have on our board from Joanne Myers of Topeka. Matching pledges, dollar for dollar right now, for the next $235 worth of pledges that we get. And we have about 20 minutes until 4 o'clock, and your opportunity to pledge for Trail Mix is going to vanish at that time. And we need to make this challenge before that happens. So your support right now is key and crucial. Whatever amount that you can give, give so at kansaspublicradio.org or 888-577-5268. And Bob, what have you got for us?
Well, what I have for us is, you know, yes, we want to meet this challenge, but I don't think it takes 20 minutes. We're going to be here with you another 4 or 5 minutes. We should meet this challenge right now. Just one of you pledging $240 would meet that $235 challenge. Two of you pledging $120, $10 a month would meet that. Four of you pledging $60 a month would meet that. We should knock that off right now. I know there's folks listening. I know you love Trail Mix because you're here right now. So help us meet this challenge in the next handful of minutes. Go to kansaspublicradio.org, kansaspublicradio.org, or call 1-888-577-5268. And we say we need this money. 84% of our budget comes from private support. It doesn't come from the government. We get a little bit of government money, but the vast majority is from you, the individual listeners. And without your support, there wouldn't be Trail Mix.
That's certainly true. You know, as you are listening to the radio today, doing whatever it is you're doing with your afternoon on this glorious afternoon, are you one of the thousands of people who do not contribute? Are you one of those people who listen for free? Maybe it's time you should do the right thing. Call 888-577-5268 and make a pledge. You've been meaning to do it, probably. You think about it, you say, well, somebody else will do it. The fact of the matter is, somebody else isn't doing it right now, and we need your pledge. So call 888-577-5268, or get online if you've got your phone, your tablet handy. It's kansaspublicradio.org. Do it now, because we're serious. We need your support. Please do it now.
You know, David, there's a saying, I don't think I created it, but maybe I did, that you can listen to this radio station for free, but it's not free for us to produce it. It costs money to produce everything on Kansas Public Radio. And the best source of that money are folks like you who listen. Now, if you're not in a position to contribute, we understand that. If you're only in a position to make a small donation, we understand that. If you're in a position, though, to spend $15 a month, or $10 a month, or $20 a month, maybe in position to pledge $500. If you can do that, that money goes into the programming you listen to. Do it now, kansaspublicradio.org.
And the way I've always liked to put it is giving to Kansas Public Radio is very affordable, because we only ask you whatever you can afford. That might mean a one-time donation of $20, or perhaps a one-time donation of $60. But some have liked to join us as sustainers. That is to say that they give an amount every month, a small amount every month, that automatically comes out of a credit card or a banking account, and that's it. They've done their part. They've set their pledge, and they've gone. They set it and forget it. You can also join us as a sustainer. Give us, say, $10 a month. Join us at the Directors Club level of $120 for the year. You can do that at kansaspublicradio.org, or, of course, 888-577-5268.
Time is running out for you to get your pledge of support into during Trail Mix. We're only $235 away from taking advantage of Joanne Myers' challenge from Topeka. Matching pledges dollar for dollar. She started off at $920, I think. Now it's just $235. We don't want to leave that money on the table. We like Joanne, but we want to take that $235, and we need your help to do it with your pledge right now at kansaspublicradio.org.
And we've got some more Trail Mix to enjoy in just a moment, and as the music plays, our volunteers are on hand, standing by, waiting to hear from you. Be the next one to support us and help meet this challenge from Joanne Myers of Topeka. It's toll-free, again, at 1-888-577-5268 or kansaspublicradio.org. And thanks for your support.
That's the really terrific fiddler and singer, Bronwyn Keith Hines, who tours with Molly Tuttle and with Billy Strings. Her own new album is called I Build a World. From that, the song Will You Ever Be Mine, guest vocals by Dudley Connell, and a lot of heavy bluegrass hitters on this one. Scott Vestal playing banjo, Dom Leslie playing mandolin, Brian Sutton playing guitar, Jeff Picker bass, Bronwyn Keith Hines, and I Built a World. We've got time for one more, and we're going to turn to an artist who will be down at the Walnut Valley Festival in Winfield. It is guitarist Beppe Gambetta, and he picks this one pretty fast. He calls it Chipmunk on KPR. Beppe Gambetta, a little tune he calls Chipmunk from his 2013 album called The American Album. Beppe Gambetta, who I first saw at Winfield, gosh, decades ago. He'll be part of the Walnut Valley Festival again this year, September 18th to the 22nd. And the info on that is at wvfest.com. I'm Bob McWilliams, your host for Trail Mix. We've got one more chance today to raise money to show your support for Trail Mix and for Kansas Public Radio. Here's what you can do to help.
All it takes is a pledge over at our website, kansaspublicradio.org, or you can also call us toll-free at 1-888-577-5268. It's Jeff Watson again with David J. Brown and Bob, encouraging you to support a rare radio program that you won't find anywhere else, one that's been here for 30 years, and one that we're looking forward to hearing in the years to come. It takes a pledge of support at kansaspublicradio.org. The number again is 888-577-5268. And I want to start by just sharing a little bit of good news, and that is, thanks to the generous support of the pledges that we've gotten this afternoon, we've met the challenge from Joanne Myers of Topeka. We were able to take her money,
right,
thanks
That's
to
great.
The pledges of support from KPR listeners. The bad news is that Bob was correct. Time is running out for you to make your pledge for Trail Mix, and we have just a couple hundred dollars that we need to raise by 4 o'clock to stay on track with our goals here at KPR. You can help make that happen. You and two others pledging at $10 a month would help take care of that goal right now. Again, it's 888-577-5268 or online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Yeah, and if you call now, you can get in on that contest. You know, we're giving away two tickets to the Dar Williams concert on November 11th. Bob's going to tell you more about that in a minute. But if you call in, you get your name in the hat, and the odds are really high because, you know, we haven't had that many calls today. And so I'd make a call if I wanted to see Dar Williams for free. That'd be really cool. And we need your money. But make a pledge. Call 888-577-5268 or get online at kansaspublicradio.org. And, you know, in all seriousness, we appreciate your support. It's been a very good afternoon, and we're really thankful for the contributions folks have made already. But we do need these three calls now. So do it now. 888-577-5268. And again, thank you.
You know, Dar Williams was getting her career going about the same time Trail Mix started. She's been a core artist on Trail Mix. She's one of the first on-air guests we had for Trail Mix, one of the first live performers. That was back in our old building, not nearly as good sound as we have in our new building. And she's come to Lawrence many times because Kansas Public Radio and Trail Mix were here so people would know about her music. So she's returning November the 11th to celebrate 30 years of Trail Mix. The concert is in the pavilion at the Lead Center here at the University of Kansas. Intimate space. It's more than three quarters sold out already. Now, you do not get tickets from the Lead Center. They don't have them. We've got them at kansaspublicradio.org. Click on shop. But if you call in today or pledge online today, you'll get entered in a drawing today for a pair of free tickets. When I mentioned, we got to that Joanne Myers challenge because of an anonymous pledge from Lawrence, Kansas, an anonymous pledge from Lenexa. And we've already gotten one call right now, addition from Caroline Seals of Topeka, Kansas, a new member. And she qualifies for the welcome box of KPR goodies that we'll send to you if you become a new member at least $120 a year. Two more calls by 4 o'clock, which will be after we stop talking, but we're still taking the pledges. Two more calls, and you'll get entered into the giveaway for the Dar Williams tickets, and you'll help us meet our goals here on Kansas Public Radio.
Yes, and it is at kansaspublicradio.org or 888-577-5268 where you can make that pledge. Just to expand a bit on what Bob was mentioning, if you're a new member and you've never pledged to Kansas Public Radio before and you're able to join us at our Director's Club level of $120, which is $10 a month, we'll send you a welcome box, which is full of all sorts of neat knickknacks and goodies. There's some refrigerator magnets, a bumper sticker, some sunglasses, just a little gesture of support. Or a little gesture of appreciation, rather, for new members joining us today at kansaspublicradio.org.
And I got to say, that bumper sticker has the ultra-cool new KPR logo.
Oh, yeah.
It's one you'll proudly display.
Quite so, quite so. We've got just about 5 minutes until 4 o'clock rolls around and a little bit more Trail Mix still to enjoy. And we want to say thank you to each and every one of you who have made a pledge for Trail Mix this afternoon. I want to say thanks to David J. Brown for taking some time out of his afternoon.
Thank you
being
for
here
having
with us.
Me.
Thanks to Emily DeMarchi for tabulating this afternoon and Max Paley for taking calls. Thanks to all of you, especially thanks to all of you who have made your pledge for Trail Mix during the fall fanfare. You can still make your pledge of support before 4 o'clock rolls around at kansaspublicradio.org or, of course, that toll-free number, 888-577-5268. We really appreciate everything you do. Thanks to all of you for your marvelous support of Kansas Public Radio.
Stardate September 7th. Charles Messier was a comet hunter, but he kept coming across annoying objects that resembled comets, so he compiled a catalog of them to keep both himself and others from wasting time, more than 100 in all. And 250 years ago tonight, while studying a comet in Cassiopeia, he discovered object number 52, a star cluster that's thousands of light years from Earth. Astronomers have been studying Messier 52 ever since then, yet they still don't know all of its details. That includes its precise distance. Measurements made in recent years have ranged from less than 5,000 light years to more than 6,000. And without knowing the cluster's distance, it's hard to nail down its other characteristics. Its age, for example, could range from 120 million to 160 million years. A study a few years ago counted 369 stars in the cluster, although the total's probably much higher. Many of the stars are crowded in its middle, but some of them are dozens of light years from there. At the cluster's edge, stars can be pulled away by the gravity of the rest of the galaxy, reducing the size of this family of stars. M52 is well up in the northeast at nightfall. It's above the sideways letter W formed by some of Cassiopeia's brighter stars. The cluster is too faint to see with the eye alone, but it's an easy target for binoculars. Tomorrow, a ruby jewel atop a stellar diamond. For the University of Texas at Austin McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
But first, Stardate on Kansas Public Radio comes from Topeka's Zoo's Brew at the Zoo, Saturday, September the 14th, featuring beer tastings, live music, games, food trucks, and animal encounters, all supporting the zoo's conservation initiatives. Tickets at topekazoo.org.
This week on KPR presents Lies and Disinformation on the Campaign Trail.
How do you navigate an environment where a whole lot of people can be political communicators at a large scale who are not candidates, they're not parties, they might not even be trying to win an election?
I'm Kay McIntyre. Join me for a conversation with Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Lie Detectives, on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock Sunday evening on Kansas Public Radio.
Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. I'm Bob McWilliams. Thanks for joining me today on Trail Mix. I've got another edition of Trail Mix, a new one tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 4. Support for Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio comes from Mass Creek Music in Lawrence, serving the world's musicians and selecting, appraising, and repairing fine acoustic and electric instruments, amplifiers, PA systems, and accessories on the web at masscreekmusic.com, and the Yoga Center of Lawrence and their Yoga Basics 8-week series starting on Thursday evening. That introduces the families of yoga poses and helps develop a consistent practice. Passes to yogacenterofLawrence.org. All things considered, next here on Kansas Public Radio.
What was a trigger for so many of our staff is when people came up and says, "I know what you're feeling." They're saying, "Oh, really?"
How do you begin to move forward after a school shooting? We'll talk to a school principal who knows all too well what it's like. For Saturday, September 7th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we'll check in with Pennsylvania voters ahead of next week's big debate in Philadelphia, and we'll look at why so many corporations are stepping back from DEI efforts.
I think what that does is kind of sends a message to people from underrepresented backgrounds in the workplace that maybe, you know, they don't belong there.
Also, what's going on with the surprisingly quiet hurricane season?
Don't let your guard down now. There are many years where we've had 7 hurricanes after September 5th.
And a review of the new Beetlejuice sequel, all that and more after this newscast. Stick with us.
Live from NPR News in New York City, I'm Dwahali Saikautel. This weekend, the presidential candidates are getting ready for their first debate in Pennsylvania. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Pittsburgh to prepare, while former President Donald Trump is rallying his base in the battleground state of Wisconsin. More from NPR's Amy Held.
Among the rules for Tuesday's debate, answers and rebuttals must be tight, 2 minutes or shorter, and no pre-written notes. Trump has dismissed the importance of studying up. His campaign says for him, connecting with voters is a form of debate prep. Harris is spending 5 days practicing in Pittsburgh. And while the debate stage in Philadelphia provides a national spotlight, Pennsylvania is pivotal for both Harris and Trump, who are spending a lot of time and money there to reach the central swing state voters. One question voters will not have answered until after the election, whether Trump will serve time behind bars. After a New York judge Friday agreed to delay sentencing for his felony hush money conviction. Amy Held, NPR News.
At a Financial Times conference in London, the head of the CIA says the U.S. is making a new ceasefire proposal for the war in Gaza. NPR's Lauren Freyer has that story.
CIA Director Bill Burns says this new, more detailed ceasefire proposal is still being worked out by the U.S. and other mediators, but that they expect to present it to Israel and Hamas soon. In an unprecedented joint appearance in London with his British counterpart, Burns said 90% of the proposal has already been agreed upon.
In any negotiation I've been involved in, the last 10% is the last 10% for a reason, because it's the hardest part to do.
Burns and MI6 Chief Richard Moore said a ceasefire would allow officials to focus then on regional risks. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
A 14-year-old is facing four counts of murder in the deaths of two teachers and two high school students at a shooting outside of Atlanta on Wednesday. As NPR's Meg Anderson reports, Georgia officials are prosecuting the teen as an adult.
All 50 states allow children to be prosecuted as adults. How that's decided varies by state, but often it depends on the crime. In Georgia, for instance, any child 13 or older charged with murder automatically ends up in adult court. Marsha Levick, chief legal officer of the Juvenile Law Center, says children should not be prosecuted as adults, even when the crime is as horrible as a school shooting.
The fact that a child commits a murder does not erase the developmental immaturity that they possess.
Criminal justice experts say nearly all juveniles who commit school shootings across the country end up being tried as adults. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Excessive heat warnings continue in California through Monday. This is NPR News from New York. The Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art has acquired work by the late illustrator Jerry Pinkney, specifically artwork from his 2009 book, The Lion and the Mouse, which earned Pinkney a Caldecott Medal, a picture book art. NPR's Andrew Limbaugh has more.
You've probably heard the story before. A lion spares a mouse's life. The mouse then saves the lion from hunters. It's an old fable, but Jerry Pinkney made it new. In his version of the story, there are barely any words. All of the story is told through Pinkney's expressive and distinctive watercolor style.
And that's something that Jerry Pinkney is a master at.
Isabel Ruiz-Gano, curator at the Eric Carle Museum.
Creating these animals with just such incredible personalities to them.
Pinkney died in 2021. His work will be on display at the museum until early next year, but it will also be archived and preserved, so Pinkney can be remembered forever. Andrew Limbaugh, NPR News.
Protest erupted across France today. President Emmanuel Macron named conservative politician Michel Barnier as the new prime minister. Barnier, who is 73, is the European Union's former Brexit negotiator, replacing France's first openly gay prime minister and the youngest, Gabriel Attal. Barnier, speaking to reporters, said discussions to form a new government, including with the left, are going well. The nationwide protests were organized by France's New Popular Front, or NFP, and trade unions. I'm Dwahli Saikautel, NPR News from New York City.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 77 and fair. Wind is from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 40s. Wind will be from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. It's 77 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather for Northeast Kansas.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The faculty of Appalachee High School in Winder, Georgia, joined a group this week that no one wants to be in, the ever-growing group of school principals, teachers, and administrators who have experienced a mass shooting. There is a network in place to help them out, a network that sadly has a lot of experience talking to people who have been in the exact same position. The Principal Recovery Network was founded in 2019 by Frank DeAngelis and others. DeAngelis was principal of Columbine High School in 1999, when two students opened fire and killed more than a dozen people. He joins us now, Frank DeAngelis. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we talked to you a few years ago after the Uvalde shootings, and you said that every time you see the headline, you get the text alert about another school shooting. It just brings it all back. I imagine happened again this week for you.
Yes, it was really strange because it's been a tough year for me. I've had some health issues, and I usually talk to my counselor, and I've been in counseling since the Columbine tragedy happened, and I had not talked to him in a while, so I had set up an appointment, and I was actually in his office, and he helped me greatly. And as I come down the stairs to leave his office, my phone's just started, so basically exploding with text messages. Are you aware of what's happening? Are you aware? And in phone calls, media calls, and I knew that there was another school shooting. And it does. It takes you back. And for us, it's been over 25 years, but there's certain things that trigger, you know, these emotions when these events happen. And it does.
Yeah. You know, we see it in so many different ways, the way that after a shooting, the media conversation, the political conversation can go several different directions. And I'm wondering for you personally, what are the things that you are thinking about in the days, in the weeks like we've yet again just had?
I'm not looking at the political things because I just had this conversation with someone. The kids that lost their lives, the teachers, they're not going to have Republican or Democrat on their caskets. You know, I look at it from the standpoint that they're all of our kids. And right away, I start thinking about the recovery piece, next steps, because I can remember when Columbine happened on April 20th of 99. It was a couple of days afterwards, and I received a phone call from a gentleman named Bill Bond, and he was the principal at Heath High School in Paducah, Kentucky, when his event happened in 1997. And he made a comment to me that still resonates today. He said, he told me who he was, and he said, "You don't even know what you need, but here's my number." And he was exactly right. And I called him, and I can remember after receiving that call, I said, "I just hope that I never have to make the call that Bill did." Well, unfortunately, since Columbine, I've made it numerous times.
So you've, like you said, been through these paces so many times and to the point where the Principal Recovery Network has put together a guide for principals of what to do next if your school has had a shooting like this. Can you tell us what the first wave of top priorities are for administrators at Appalachia High School right now?
My first thing when I make a phone call, as I've done over the years, the first thing I ask is, what are you doing to take care of yourself? Because right now, the principal and the others that are there just feel the need to take care of everyone else. And then the second piece is stating you're not in this journey alone. The most difficult challenge is keeping everyone together. We could all experience the same event, but how we deal with it, we deal with it differently. And I think that was one of my most difficult things. And I used to share, you know, when a family goes through a tragedy, we need to come together. And that was the most important thing. And I think that's a key message to them, that they're not in this journey alone. And you know, the other message I think so many people wonder is, when is it going to get back to normal? And you really have to redefine what normal is. And people don't want to hear that.
So there's the help that people like you can give, that unique experience, reaching out, giving advice, having been there before. What do you think this community needs from the rest of us, whether it's people who live directly in their community or elsewhere in the country? What's the best way to be supported when you've gone through a terrible experience like this? You see all the media cameras show up, your friends have died, you're scared to go back to school, but you've got to continue your education and get back into it at some point.
Right. Right. And I think just reaching out, and I think a phrase, a lot of times people don't understand what to say. And sometimes it's just better to be quiet at a standpoint just to offer support. Because I know what was a trigger for so many of our people or staff is when people came up and says, "I know what you're feeling." They're saying, "Oh, really? Were you locked in a classroom? Did your best friend just die?" And it's very difficult not knowing what to say, but just offering that support and reaching out. And I think the other thing, too, is their school year just started. And so they really have, you know, 8 or 9 more months before, you know, the end of the school year. And For us, we were at a point that we were exactly 1 month away, a little over a month from the seniors graduating, and then about 5 weeks from school being dismissed. And so we had summer, you know, to kind of regroup, and but we also had to provide hope or support for those people. But it's going to be difficult going back in right now. I can remember when we came back to Columbine to start the new school year, there would be flowers and teddy bears. And a lot of times when people would walk through those doors, it constantly reminded them of what had happened. And I think things, simple things like that. And there were so many people that wanted to be helpful. And originally we put all these signs down the hallways and students came to me and said, Mr. D, we appreciate the support of everyone, but it's constantly reminding us what happened. And so I think you got to be aware of, even though you feel you're helping, there's certain things that trigger the emotions of people within your building.
That's Frank DeAngelis, the former principal of Columbine High School and a member of the Principal Recovery Network. Thanks so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you so much.
Philadelphia is getting ready to host the first general election debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and her Republican rival, former President Donald Trump. Reporter Carmen Russell Sluchansky of member station WHYY joins us now from Philadelphia. Hey there.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
Well, I'm good. Let's just start with the logistics. The debate's going to be held at the National Constitution Center. It's hosted a lot of high-profile political events over the years, but it's a busy stretch of town. It's right by the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, and, you know, I'll just add, of course, WHYY. What's it looking like right now?
Well, Scott, I am literally watching 7 to 8 foot barriers go up along the street from the window here at WHYY as we speak. Starting tomorrow, we expect many of the roads around the center to be closed off, and by Monday, several blocks will be within a heavily fortified perimeter.
So Philadelphians, as we know, are not shy about offering their opinions. How do people who live and work in the neighborhood feel about all of this?
Well, you know, I went out and I walked around talking to people earlier, and really no one seems to mind it. And in fact, people seem to think it's kind of appropriate to have the debate here, being that it is like the birthplace of American democracy. For example, this is Eileen Fink.
This is the Constitution was written here. Because this is where it all began. And I understand we're very much a swing state. It's a very divided state between Republicans and Democrats. And it's a very large state.
And Carmen, Pennsylvania's been the center of attention for several elections in a row. But in this particular election, it just seems like outsized attention, an incredible amount of attention from candidates this cycle.
So much. You know, just this week, Harris and her running mate, Tim Walz, were campaigning in Pittsburgh. Donald Trump just had a town hall in Harrisburg. His running mate, J.D. Vance, has already made several visits, which all really speaks to, like you're saying, how important the state's 19 electoral votes are. But history also tells us the vote's just going to be close, whichever way it goes. Biden won by only 80,000 votes in 2020, and Trump won in 2016 by only 40,000.
Any sense of how the change of the Democratic ticket has affected voters' views on this race?
Yeah, overall, polling shows that there was a shift in support, with Harris doing marginally better than Biden was in a matchup with Trump. But that race, but the race also remains extremely close, effectively a tie. And our reporting really bears this out, with there being, you know, showing more excitement around Harris than there was for Biden, especially among younger voters we spoke to. So this is Shiva Sharma, who I met at a recent campaign event.
I am super excited to be voting for the first president of color, and I feel like this is going to be, like I said, a life-changing moment for young girls just like me.
I'm curious, first of all, if you've been able to find any undecided voters out there, and if so, what they're looking for from this debate in particular.
Yeah, we don't find many undecided voters, but Eileen Fink, who we heard from earlier, is actually one, and she told me she plans to vote, but she's not really excited about it because she believes neither candidate is addressing some really important issues.
I think one of the issues that are not strongly being spoken about is the environment and not just climate change. There are so many other things about our environment that need help.
I should point out, she did say she might vote for Harris as a vote against Donald Trump.
Got it. Well, let's talk about one big environmental issue in Pennsylvania, and that's fracking. The state is a major natural gas producer because of fracking. Harris used to be fully opposed to it. Now says she's changed her mind. How is that being received?
Well, when I talk to Republicans in the state, they bring up Democrats' opposition to fracking as a reason to vote for Trump, since they, you know, they see it as a jobs issue. Now, however, to be clear, Harris's views now seem to coincide with much of the Pennsylvania's Democratic leadership as well, who will call for regulating fracking but not really banning it.
Yeah. And what about other issues? Any other issues that Trump supporters bring up when it comes to what they're looking for from this debate?
Immigration is another top issue for Republicans, much as it is around the country. They also talk about the economy, especially inflation. So, for example, this is Derek Mason, who lives in Chester, just southwest of Philadelphia.
I think economically, you know, we're definitely headed in the wrong direction. Prices is booming. So, you know, things need to start to come down. And, you know, I think he's the guy for it.
Mason did say he's going to watch the debate before he made a final decision.
All right. That is Carmen Russell-Sluchansky of member station WHYY. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from the Kansas City Zoo and Aquarium, open year-round featuring nearly 10,000 animals. Admission supports the zoo's conservation fund, preserving wildlife at home and around the world. More at kansascityzoo.org. And Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, clear skies, a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow sunny with a high near 80, a low in the mid-50s for Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Dwahli Sykautau in New York City with these headlines. During a campaign stop in Pittsburgh today, Democratic nominee Kamala Harris said she is honored to have the endorsements of former Vice President Dick Cheney and his daughter Liz, both longtime Republicans. Three tribal leaders have sent an open letter to both presidential candidates, asking them to prioritize native issues such as the protection of natural resources and tribal lands. And the Centers for Disease Control says a person in Missouri with no known contact with animals has recovered from bird flu after being hospitalized with the illness and given influenza antiviral medications. I'm Dwahli Sykautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From American Jewish World Service, supporting human rights advocates worldwide in the fight for democracy, equity, and justice for all people. Learn more at ajws.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. It was called the Summer of Racial Reckoning.
George Floyd! Say his name! George Floyd!
In the wake of the murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, protests erupted across the country, calling for an end to police brutality and systemic racism. And as tens of thousands took to the streets, some of America's largest corporations joined the call for racial justice.
In Nike's new ad, the shoemaker is using its Just Do It brand to say what not to do. Don't turn your back on racism.
Microsoft is joining Amazon and IBM in refusing to sell its facial recognition software to police.
So far, companies have pledged more than $1.7 billion to advance racial justice.
They pledged to take a stand against systemic racism, donated millions to organizations that fight for social justice, promised to support businesses run by women, people of color, and members of the LGBTQ community. And some companies went a step further, extending the social justice narrative and creating programs to incorporate the goals of diversity, equity, and inclusion in hiring, retaining, and promoting talent.
I have resigned as a member of the Reddit board. I have urged them to fill my seat with a black candidate.
But almost as soon as companies embraced DEI, the landscape of corporate reckoning
began to shift.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI programs, are under attack by conservative lawmakers.
Lowe's scrapping their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs after facing
pressure. Harley Davidson is the latest company to drop diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives.
Technology companies, including Alphabet, the parent company of Google, also Meta platforms, have made big cuts to those DEI programs.
Backlash against DEI gained momentum with the June 2023 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that abolished affirmative action admissions in colleges. And while the law only applied to higher learning, it created a legal opening for those who oppose DEI policies in the workplace. I spoke with Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman about this last spring, and he pointed out the affirmative action ruling could stifle companies' ability to consider racial diversity in hiring.
They will no longer tell themselves when they're making a hiring decision, well, if we have two roughly comparable candidates, this candidate adds racial diversity to our workforce, and therefore we should hire that person, because they'll be concerned that the courts will find that to be unlawful discrimination.
Over the past 4 years, many of the companies that so publicly embrace DEI policies have been backing away. What are the politics behind the DEI backlash, and what happens when workplace diversity initiatives are lost? We called up David Glasgow. He's the executive director of the Melzer Center for Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging at the NY School of Law. And I started by asking him to define DEI as he sees it.
Yeah, so I think it's helpful to actually pick apart the three letters in the acronym of DEI because they each mean different things. So the D part for diversity is really about, you know, diversifying the personnel in a particular institution. So you might focus on hiring, retention, or promotion, just to make sure that the people at the top of the organization or being brought into the organization kind of match the demographics of the applicant pool of a local labor pool. The E for equity is really about, you know, ensuring basic, you know, fairness in the way that your organizational systems and processes operate. So fairness in things like your employee benefits programs or how you hire people, the work assignments that people get, opportunities for mentorship and the like. And then the I is for inclusion, and that's really about workplace and institutional culture. So do you have the kind of environment where people show up to work each day feeling respected, feeling that their voice is heard, that they're able to contribute their best ideas and be treated well by their colleagues and by their supervisors? And so together, the acronym is really just about, you know, how do we ensure that in this, you know, diverse multicultural society that we live in, that, you know, people of a whole variety of different, you know, backgrounds and identities feel that they can, you know, succeed and thrive inside their institutions.
What do you think the people that you're observing are getting wrong about this from your point of view and how they're talking about these programs and efforts and what they do?
So I think the major thing that they're getting wrong is by reducing all of DEI to, you know, what they often call racial preferences. So I think the way that they're framing DEI is that certain groups are getting an unfair advantage over other groups in access to opportunities in the workplace. Whereas, you know, DEI is just such a broad umbrella term that includes a whole range of practices that go well beyond that. So, you know, if you're an organization that sets, you know, merit-based criteria for recruitment and promotion, or has a, you know, structured interview process where you make sure that all candidates are assessed against the same criteria, I would consider that to be a DEI program, right? Even though no one is given any sort of preference or advantage in that kind of a system. Or if you think about things like, you know, parental leave or flexible work arrangements or childcare support. Again, you know, I see that as a DEI sort of program to help, you know, parents of young children and women advance within the organization. Or if you do outreach to broaden, you know, candidate pools of people who are applying for jobs at your organization. So I think the biggest mistake that they do, and, you know, I think honestly, in some cases, it is quite deliberate, is to really zoom in on just the kind of DEI practices that aim to specifically uplift a particular marginalized group in the workplace, and then treat that as though that's all of what DEI is.
Flip side, what do you think the most legitimate critique of DEI is when it comes to how it has been practiced by large corporations who have thrown a lot of time and effort and resources into the last few years particularly?
Yeah, so a couple of things. You know, one is that I think sometimes it's not implemented with a lot of rigor. I think some organizations will just rush to implement a kind of one-off, you know, unconscious bias training or something, and not really think deeply about the design of the program, you know, who's running it, is this research backed or not? And so there's a lot of you know, quality variance. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have sat through, you know, some terrible diversity trainings in their time. So I think that kind of slapdash and unrigorous approach to DEI is one component of it. And then I think another legitimate criticism is really approaches to DEI that involve, you know, excessive shaming and cancellation. You know, I think one of the seeds of the backlash was planted, you know, many years ago at the peak of what, you know, some people at that time were calling cancel culture, where, you know, a lot of people were feeling really fearful about, you know, if they make one mistake, if they use, you know, a piece of terminology that's out of date that they didn't realize was outdated, that they were going to get, you know, shamed by other people, you know, in their workplaces or in their, you know, schools or what have you. And so I think those kinds of approaches to DEI are not particularly helpful and have just kind of given fuel to the anti-DEI activists' fire.
Lastly, as we talk in this moment of several major companies scaling these initiatives back, what do you think the biggest thing that's lost is when a company does do that?
Well, I think the biggest thing that's lost is the kind of culture that I was describing at the outset of our conversation, where people of all sort of backgrounds and identities feel that they have an opportunity to succeed within the organization. I think what that does is kind of sends a message to people from underrepresented backgrounds in the workplace that maybe, you know, they don't belong there, or that they don't have a path to, you know, promotion or a path to succeed within the organization. And so, yeah, I just think it's incumbent on organizations to, you know, not just consider the risks that are coming from the anti-DEI side, you know, legal and reputational risks, but also really think about the risks from the other side and what's lost if you retreat from DEI.
That's David Glasgow, Executive Director of the Meltzer Center for Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging at NYU's School of Law. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you.
Millions of children worldwide have fled violent conflict to relocate to safer places like the United States. Studies show that refugee kids in this country experience high levels of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress. But research also shows that supporting the families of refugee kids in specific ways can prevent some of these problems. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee went to Maine to see how it works.
It's mid-afternoon and Shabana Siddiqui has just hopped into an Uber.
The address is 17.
Siddiqui is from Afghanistan and moved to the U.S. with her husband in 2022. And for the past couple of years, she's worked in the Lewiston-Auburn area in Maine with a project helping refugee families. It's an effort run jointly by Boston College and the local nonprofit Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services. On this day, Siddiqui is visiting a family she's been working with for a few months.
There's a two caregiver family, a mom and a dad, and they have two sons here.
A 19-year-old and a 12-year-old. The family arrived in the U.S. in January this year, after more than 2 years of living in fear under the Taliban.
When the government collapsed and Taliban took over, they were really scared for their lives.
The 12-year-old boy has struggled with symptoms of anxiety and post-traumatic stress.
One day, he was at school and he got pushed by a bully. But then it triggered him so much that he started crying and he had an even panic attack.
Here. The Uber drops us off on a wide tree-lined street with big houses on either side. Siddiqui walks up to a house and knocks on the front door.
Yeah, somebody's coming.
A lanky boy with big eyes and thick black hair opens the door.
Assalamu alaikum, Dabarjan.
This is Mujibur Rahman, the 12-year-old Siddiqui told me about. His parents, Khadija and Muhammad Rahmani, are waiting upstairs outside their first-floor apartment. They greet Siddiqui in their mother tongue, Dari. Later, sitting in her own one-bedroom apartment, Siddiqui explains that the program relies on people like her with the same background to be community health workers.
You go as a friend and you build rapport so they can easily share everything with you.
She says newly resettled refugees are overwhelmed by the stress of building a new life in a new country.
Initially, language barrier is the biggest obstacle you face in the country. And the next would be the financial restraint.
It can take a long time for refugees to find a job, even if they're fluent in English, as Siddiqui was when she arrived.
I applied for like 3-4 jobs at a time. I was applying for this website, that website, called here and called there and called Career Center.
But nothing came through for a while.
That takes a really big toll on your mental health. I was so anxious. I was diagnosed with anxiety because my mind was running 100 miles per hour. Like here, there, here, there, in order to just get a job.
Siddiqui says it also took months for her and her husband to find an apartment they could rent because they had no credit history. All this stress, she says, takes a toll on families.
I can even tell you from my own experience that the lack of getting a job or unemployment, it really strains your relationship.
Strains relationships and creates conflict. Teresa Betancourt directs the research program on children and adversity at Boston College.
There can sometimes be an elevated risk for violence within the home.
Especially because parents are also struggling with their past traumas.
We know this from military families that when parents are exposed to significant violence in other settings and they come back to rejoin their family environments, we can see elevated problems with emotion regulation, sometimes more harsh disciplinary practices or harsh interactions between parent and children.
And that worsens the risk of mental health problems in kids. But when parents are doing well, they can buffer their kids from the long-term impacts of past trauma and stresses. And so Betancourt developed this program to prevent long-term mental health problems in refugee kids.
We're really trying to work with the family a lot earlier with a prevention focus and a mental health promotion focus.
Parents learn positive parenting skills as well as ways to better manage their own stress, say by using mindfulness strategies. It also helps parents navigate everyday stresses. Betancourt and her team piloted the effort in Lewiston, Somali, and Bhutanese communities. Families who participated reported fewer family arguments and a reduction in symptoms of depression and traumatic stress in their kids. Khadija Rahmani tells me how Siddiqui has supported her. For example, when she was struggling with learning English.
She motivated me, saying, it's not hard. At least you are educated. You can read and write, which will help you learn English.
Siddiqui also helped Khadija find a job.
She guided me to a place where women work.
And all of them are Afghan women at FedEx.
And she says Siddiqui has had a huge impact on her youngest son, Mujib, who struggled the most.
Shabana sat with him, told him good stories, talked about safety and security. She said, this place is safe and you don't need stress.
She encouraged him to engage more at school, which had been a big source of anxiety for him. Khadija says Mujib loves it when Siddiqui visits and talks to her a lot about his life. Mujib confirms that.
We talk about English, we talk about my school, we talk about everything.
And it's helping him start to move past the shadow of old traumas and towards building a hopeful future in this country. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. There are more than 3 million pipelines in the United States that transport natural gas, crude oil, and hazardous liquids underground. In recent years, there have been a lot of proposals for new carbon dioxide pipelines tied to a technology called carbon capture and storage. It's a technology that, in theory, can address climate change. One of the largest proposed pipelines is in the Midwest, as Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports.
Marjorie Swan and her sister own about 600 acres of farmland in northern Iowa. They drive past green fields of corn and soybeans.
This farm is third generation for us, too. This was our grandfather's.
After one of the mile markers, Swan points from the fence line to the horizon. Summit Carbon Solutions wants to bury a pipeline here as part of a 2,500-mile network in the Midwest. Their goal is to capture CO2 emissions from nearly 60 ethanol plants, half of which are in Iowa, transport it through South Dakota, and store it underground in North Dakota. Some supporters say this plan would help the country meet its greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. Summit CEO Lee Blank says that's not the motivation of the company.
We don't argue climate change, but ultimately there are many people that do believe in it. And those people that believe in climate change are willing to pay additional premiums for products that are lower carbon or carbon responsible.
This summer, Iowa's utility regulators approved Summit's initial permit application and the right to use eminent domain on properties where landowners don't sign voluntary easements. That was tough news for Swan to hear after 3 years of fighting the pipeline.
I just got a big knot in my stomach. I just kind of like, really? But now after finding out more things, it's not over. It's definitely not over.
That's because the fight in Iowa is expected to shift more into the courts in the coming months, and because Summit needs permits in both North and South Dakota before construction can begin in Iowa.
We feel confident that we'll get our permits.
That's Summit COO Jimmy Powell. He says Summit is trying to accommodate landowners without using eminent domain.
We're spending a lot of time working with landowners, trying to make sure that they feel informed. And then if they feel comfortable signing an agreement, which 3/4 of the landowners have, then they do.
In South Dakota, Summit needs to reapply for a route permit after state regulators denied its first application. In North Dakota, state officials are expected to decide whether to grant Summit permits later this fall. North Dakota rancher Kurt Swenson is part of the Northwest Landowners Association, which is suing North Dakota over underground storage laws. His land sits atop part of the geological formation where up to 18 million tons of carbon dioxide could be stored each year, whether he and his family agree to it or not.
Ultimately, we will not let this project of sequestration move forward with Summit until they treat landowners in a constitutional manner the way that they deserve to be treated, and right now they are not doing that.
Shannon Raisler, a law professor at the University of Iowa, says the opposition to CO2 pipelines is part of a bigger trend around recent large-scale infrastructure projects.
These tax credits that are providing this incentives to do this now were part of landmark climate legislation, along with a lot of other things that people in local communities didn't really deliberate.
One place they will deliberate is in South Dakota. Voters will decide in November whether a new state law that could lower the bar for permits for pipeline companies will stand. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Kramer in Ames, Iowa.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. This is NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris will meet in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate Tuesday night. It's the second presidential debate of the election season, taking place in a dramatically different race for the White House. KPR and NPR will bring you live coverage of the debate Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Tonight in northeast to east central Kansas, clear skies, a low of 49 degrees. Sunny for Sunday, a high of 80. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the mid-50s, and then on Monday it should be sunny with highs around 85. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Dwahli Saikautal in New York City with these headlines. Former President Donald Trump is campaigning in Wisconsin this weekend, this time near Wausau and Stevens Point. He spoke to a crowd for more than an hour and a half behind bulletproof glass for added security. Carmaker Stellantis is recalling nearly 1.5 million Ram pickup trucks globally. The company says certain trucks from 2019 through this year may have faulty anti-lock brake software. And in Oregon, the body of a nurse who was reported missing days ago has been found. Beaverton police and local officials say a neighbor has been charged with the murder of 32-year-old Melissa Jubain. I'm Dwahli Saikautal, NPR News in New York.
Former President...
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
According to a Washington Post database, police officers in the U.S. have shot and killed 91 people who were in the midst of a mental health crisis this year alone. One in five people killed by the police in the last decade, 1,968 people, were experiencing a mental health crisis, and many others have been assaulted by police, arrested, or hospitalized against their will. And this has all fueled a movement. More than 100 cities, including many of the country's largest, Denver, Chicago, Houston, New York, have launched what are called alternative crisis response programs. Instead of armed police, social workers and EMTs now handle 911 calls involving mental illness, addiction, or suicidal thoughts. The health policy news organization Trade-Offs teamed up with the Marshall Project to produce The Fifth Branch, a new podcast about this new generation of first responders. The series focuses on one of the most highly regarded programs in the country, Durham, North Carolina's Holistic Empathetic Assistance Response Teams, which people in town called HEART. In this excerpt of The Fifth Branch, Trade-Offs producer Ryan Levy asks a critical question facing these programs. Do they keep their unarmed responders safe?
A lot of people are worried about David Prater. Well, not David specifically. People in his line of work. Unarmed mental health workers who respond to unpredictable 911 calls. They worry responders like David will get hurt. HEART takes the concern seriously, so after every call, David and his coworkers have to answer a question.
Did you feel safe during this encounter?
Between their unarmed teams, clinicians in the 911 call center, and co-response with police, HEART has answered 15,000 calls. 99% of the time, responders said they felt safe. 99% is the number we'll use to think about the safety of the people who respond to these calls. After riding around with David and other HEART units for 30 hours, I realized why that number is so high.
Do you live outside or do you have a home?
I assumed my ride-alongs in HEART's white minivans would feel like some mental health ambulance. You know, we'd race from one crisis to the next. But mostly, it was pretty quiet. Checking up on an elderly couple.
Your dentist was just really worried.
Gas station owners with panhandling complaints.
They just asked if you wouldn't do that in front of their store. Are you okay with that?
I'm okay with that.
We gave people rides, helped people in their homes. None of it felt dangerous. HEART director Ryan Smith says,
we first looked at what were the calls that other cities already had some evidence to support that it was safe to do this work.
Ryan analyzed tens of thousands of calls nationwide. He learned unarmed teams had been safely responding to these calls since the 1980s. Trespassing, wellness checks, intoxication. Durham's own 911 data showed those calls rarely ended in violence for police. But just like with firefighters, EMS, and cops, Ryan says there's no escaping the danger that comes with this job.
I think it would be a mistake and disingenuous to kind of gloss over the risk and uncertainty that is inherent in any 911 call.
Ryan has tried to mitigate that risk. If a weapon is present, a HEART social worker responds with a police officer. Same thing when someone threatens violence. Durham police train HEART staff to stay alert on scene, and the program outfits teams with police radios to get back up fast. But taking on some risk, that's the job.
I think that's part of what being a public servant is. I think government at its best is shifting burden and risk away from those that we serve to those who are signed up to be public servants.
Police in America have shot and killed 1,939 people in the middle of a mental health crisis in the last decade. One of every five police killings. Ryan believes, like the other branches of public safety, it's worth putting HEART's first responders in harm's way to lower the risk that someone in crisis is hurt by the police. Of course, some disagree with this idea. But some, like David Prater, agree.
It is a sacred duty.
David's official title is Peer Support Specialist.
I don't come to this work with a master's degree like our clinicians do. I come to this work with lived experience of homelessness, of a substance use disorder, with criminal convictions.
David told me about the years he spent addicted to crystal meth, living on the streets in Durham and Atlanta, talking to the worker when the husband storms in.
He got out of the car, and went in to let management at the gas station know how unhappy he was.
Very unhappy.
The management of the gas station's response was to show the gentleman the very large gun that they had behind the register. And so in this scene, we've got an armed teller and an angry husband, and they are yelling at each other.
David's reaction is swift.
So I put my body in between theirs.
I want to pause the story right there for a bit of context. Why David inserted himself with that big gun on the counter helps explain why heart responders report feeling safe 99% of the time. First, David knows he's got backup. Police are always a radio call away. Second, a bunch of people at Heart told me they have a real faith in this work.
When we arrive at a call, we have no arrest power. We have no weapons. We are trying to help somebody get their needs met.
And third, Heart has hired a bunch of people willing to make sacrifices.
Is there a level of risk in this job? There is. Do I consider it an acceptable risk? I do.
As soon as that gun was out, protocol demanded David call Durham PD. Instead, his instincts took over.
We didn't want this gas station owner to hurt someone. We didn't want this angry husband to go to jail. And so I absorbed the risk in that situation by putting myself physically between them.
It worked. The husband walked away. The gas station worker offered David coffee as thanks. Again, most Heart calls are not this intense. The point of David's story for me is that they can be, but the evidence shows responders can handle it. Heart's unarmed teams have responded to more than 8,000 calls. They've only called for police backup over any personal safety concern 5 times, 0.06%. This work can also take an emotional toll. I certainly felt drained after seeing people in crisis day after day. A paranoid older woman who kept dialing 911. Mother with 2 kids about to be evicted with nowhere to go. So many people just trying to survive. David tells me he knows all about it from an old job.
If somebody called me at 1 a.m. with a crisis, I was expected to support them through that.
Before Heart, David helped people with severe mental illness and addiction at a local nonprofit.
I would drive thousands of miles every month, running people around to different appointments, to courthouses, to doctors, to therapists.
All those hours, and still, David watched his clients fail to land housing, hold down a job, or stay on their meds. David could feel like a failure, and he'd take it out on himself.
It was overwhelming for me, and I reached a breaking point working with clients.
It could get so bad, sometimes he'd bite himself, hit himself in the head with a metal coffee mug.
This work can bleed into every part of your life if you let it.
Director Ryan Smith says Heart offers responders free counseling. Supervisors regularly check in, tell folks to take a break after a tough call, and turn off at the end of their 12-hour shifts. David says those boundaries and support are huge.
That rest and recovery time is what enables me to show up at my best and show up fully when I do come to work.
I heard this from a lot of people at Heart, and it seems to be working. The department has only replaced 6 people on a staff of 55 over their first 2 years. For David, at the end of most shifts, before he drives home, he stops.
I take up a moment before I start the car, and I close my eyes and I take a deep breath and I exhale the day.
All the hurt he's seen, all the people he couldn't help. In this small way, David keeps himself safe.
And then I start the car.
That was Ryan Levy, the lead producer of the special podcast series The Fifth Branch from Trade-Offs and The Marshall Project. You can listen to all 3 episodes of The Fifth Branch now by searching for Trade-Offs wherever you listen to podcasts or by going to tradeoffs.org/The Fifth Branch. It is peak hurricane season in the Atlantic, but there have not been many storms recently. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports that this quiet period appears to be coming to an end.
The Atlantic hurricane season goes from June all the way through November, but most storms usually happen between late August and the end of October. This year, August and September have been strangely quiet. There hasn't been a hurricane since August 12th. Matthew Rosenkranz is the lead hurricane forecaster for the National Weather Service.
It has been quiet. It has been anomalously quiet. It's weird to have a quiet period during this part of the season.
But that won't last, he says.
I think there's a lot more of the hurricane season left to go.
On average, 70% of storms in a given year happen between August 20th and October 31st. So, right now. And he says the reason for the lull in storms in the last few weeks is that moisture coming off West Africa, which hurricanes need when they're forming, has been hanging out in an abnormal spot, farther north than usual. So it's been hard for storms to develop. But those conditions in the Atlantic are changing, and because of climate change, the water in the Atlantic is incredibly warm compared to normal, which helps storms get big and powerful. That's why forecasters expect a lot of storms could form in the coming weeks.
Don't let your guard down now. There are many years where we've had seven hurricanes after September 5th.
There are already signs that the season might be picking up. There have been multiple disturbances in the Atlantic just this week, basically areas where it looks like a storm might form. Of course, not all hurricanes that do form will hit the U.S., or even hit land at all, but it only takes one to cause a ton of damage, says Rosenkranz.
I do hope people have taken this lull to prepare, because the storms are going to come at some point. The planet makes them, they are coming at some point.
Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
It's been 36 years since Hollywood let loose a trickster demon named Beetlejuice.
It's showtime. Now, let's turn on the juice and see what shakes loose.
The 1988 horror comedy proved Michael Keaton could play pretty much anything and made Tim Burton a bankable director. Now they are back with other members of the original cast for a sequel called Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Critic Bob Mondello seems to have found it vaguely haunting.
You know how some movies just speak to you?
Jesus, Bob.
Well, this one certainly has its moments.
Can't you see him concentrating here?
For instance, practical visual effects really appeal to me, and the original had them, partly because digital effects weren't a thing yet. Today, with everything CGI, Tim Burton getting back to trick-or-treat scares feels pleasantly nostalgic.
You're a figment of my imagination.
Really? Is this a figment of your imagination?
The story more or less follows the old one. The Dietz family still owns that haunted house on a hill. Lydia Dietz, Winona Ryder's goth teen, is now a goth TV psychic.
The living, the dead, can they coexist?
Who is now a goth mom with a disaffected daughter of her own.
Ghosts aren't real.
Who will, of course, need rescuing from ghosts, leading Lydia to summon the afterlife's least reliable demon.
I can't believe I'm doing this. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
I'm needed upstairs. Bob, go down the fort.
Will do. Michael Keaton is more covered in moss than last time, but seems otherwise unchanged, still carrying a torch for Lydia.
Long-distance relationships can be difficult, especially when one of you is dead and the other's ignoring it for 30 years. But Lydia and I, we have a definite psychic connection.
They're joined by Catherine O'Hara as Lydia's stepmom.
What?
Always uncanny.
Why?
Now otherworldly.
No! No! No!
Leah, what's wrong?
Oh, I'm trying to capture the perfect primal scream. I'm going to blow it up, mount it on the wall, and I invite all of you to do the same.
There are some nifty visual bits, like Monica Bellucci stitching her own body parts together in the afterlife's Lost and Found so she can do her thing.
She's a soul sucker.
You can say that again. And backstory about her.
My ex-wife is back.
Provided in a black-and-white film trailer in Italian.
In un'epoca dimenticata.
Along with musical riffs, puppet sandworms, and a personal fave, Shrunken Head Bob. In short, it's pretty clear Tim Burton and company are enjoying retracing their steps, and if you've a soft spot for the first Beetlejuice, you probably will too. Still, as much fun as Michael Keaton seems to be having revisiting past glories, both here and as Batman in last year's Flash, this film is so unsurprising and unedgy that it's hard to imagine there'll be much call for conjuring him and his pals back for a third Beetlejuice anytime soon.
Bob, you and the boys stand guard. Nobody gets through.
Maybe in another 36 years. I'm Bob Mondello.
On tomorrow's show, I talk to director Tim Burton about that movie and about a career that has brought us Batman, Jack Skellington, and Edward Scissorhands. I asked him about all the constants through his films.
Well, I mean, and I thought I sort of kind of grew out of it, but the thing is, you don't grow out of that stuff, you know. Once you feel those feelings, you always feel the same way. And I was never felt like a proficient enough filmmaker that I could change my stuff, you know. I mean, my drawings look like my drawings, you know. Nothing I can do about it.
That conversation on tomorrow's All Things Considered. That's All Things Considered for tonight. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your evening.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From American Jewish World Service, supporting human rights advocates worldwide in the fight for democracy, equity, and justice for all people. Learn more at ajws.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU in KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. K210 CR in Atchison, 89.9. And K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Saturday afternoon. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Community Village Lawrence, a local volunteer-based nonprofit dedicated to supporting affordable in-home aging for adults, helping neighbors live independently as long as possible. Details at communityvillagelawrence.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, clear skies, a low of 49 degrees. Sunny tomorrow with a high near 80 for Sunday night, clear with lows in the mid-50s, and sunny on Monday with a high of 85. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
My sister had bought an Almond Joy, and she'd steamed the package. She'd opened it. She'd pulled it out. She'd taken a bar of soap. She'd carved it in the shape of an Almond Joy. She'd melted chocolate over. She'd put it back. She'd glued it back and given it to me with this thing of sisterly love, and I am like going, oh, why do you do that? And my sister goes, because in this world there are winners and losers, and you are a loser.
Next up, the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told before a live audience. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse. In this hour, winners and losers. Stories about games and the art of competition.
Fast forward real quick. I'm a freshman in college, and I make a list of 10 things that she's done to me in childhood that I'm going to repay her for.
That story and more coming up on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX, right after the news. Live from NPR News in New York City, I'm Dwahli Sykautow. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump campaigned in the swing state of Wisconsin today. The former president spent part of his speech focusing on a judge's decision to delay sentencing in his hush money case until after the November election. Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM reports.
Former President Donald Trump was scheduled to be sentenced September 18th after being found guilty in May on 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide payments to an adult film star. But a New York judge Friday delayed the sentencing until November 26th. Trump defended the change Saturday while speaking at an airport rally in Mosinee, Wisconsin.
Because everyone realizes that there's no case because I did nothing wrong. Did nothing wrong. Political witch hunt.
Judge Juan Merchan says he's delayed the sentencing to avoid any appearance of political bias and to not be seen as trying to influence the November election. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
A bid to legalize abortion in Missouri is in jeopardy after a ruling by a county judge. From St. Louis Public Radio, Jason Rosenbaum reports on the latest involving a proposed constitutional amendment to enshrine the procedure.
A group called Missourians for Constitutional Freedom had gathered several hundred thousand signatures to amend the state's constitution to protect abortion rights and effectively repeal the state's near-total ban. But Cole County Judge Christopher Limbaugh on Friday ruled the amendment can't go before voters because it didn't specify which state laws it's repealing. Backers of the amendment immediately appealed Limbaugh's decision. Missouri's deadline to remove something from the ballot is Tuesday, meaning courts will need to decide on the measure's fate soon. For NPR News, I'm Jason Rosenbaum in St. Louis.
Another overnight drone attack by Russia targeted Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports that debris from a drone landed outside Ukraine's heavily protected parliament building.
NPR heard multiple explosions overnight in central Kyiv. The sound of Ukraine's air defense shooting down most drones launched by Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told business leaders in Italy on Friday that Ukraine is building underground schools and more shelters to keep civilians safe.
And we are setting up underground weapons production facilities so Ukrainian soldiers can defend themselves even when supplies from our partners are delayed.
Zelensky said the war might end sooner if Ukraine could use long-range missiles from the West to strike at military targets in Russia, an approach the U.S. has pushed against. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
And this is NPR News from New York. Some unusual fall films will be following in the animated footsteps of Inside Out 2. NPR's Bob Mondello says Hollywood has decided animation's not just for kids.
Stop-action drama, puppet horror, all sorts of genres are experimenting with animation this fall. Nowhere more surprisingly than an interview about singer-songwriter Pharrell Williams.
You know what would be cool is if we told my story with Lego pieces.
Seriously?
Yes, Lego.
The documentary is called Piece by Piece. Other unusual animated films include Abruptio, a stop-action horror comedy.
My name is Les Hackle, and I have a bomb in my neck.
And the bittersweet stop-action drama, Memoir of a Snail.
Life was fleeting, but so precious.
Not to suggest Hollywood's animators have forgotten youngsters, they'll have Transformers 1, based on the Hasbro toy, Pixar's Moana 2, and The Wild Robot. They just won't have animation all to themselves. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
Ahead of next week's presidential debate in Philadelphia on Tuesday, three tribal leaders sent an open letter to both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, asking them to prioritize native issues such as the protection of natural resources and tribal lands and health equity. In at least seven states, including Wisconsin, Michigan, and Arizona, the native vote can be the tipping point in the presidential election. That's according to reporting by Native News Online and other indigenous news outlets. This is NPR News from New York City. I'm Dwali Saikautau.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Sarah Austin Janess. I come from a game-playing family. Growing up, we played dominoes, Uno, gin rummy, and pounce, which is competitive solitaire. We also love backgammon. And in fact, my great aunt Fanny, at 97 years old and right before she died, beat my mom in a backgammon match. Aunt Fanny always played to win. So this hour is all about play and competition. It's an hour with winners, and because the moth loves an underdog, plenty of losers too. First up is Joey Garfield, who finally gets to hang out with the big kids on the block. Joey told us at a Moth Story Slam in Chicago, where we partner with public radio station WBEZ. Here's Joey, live at the Moth.
So, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, I was upstairs in my room, just beautiful summer day, minding my own business, when I hear some shouting from the backyard, like a lot of voices. And they're going, "Joey, come outside, it's not coming to Mr. Board!" I was like, "What?" Like, "Joey, come outside, this is just hot dog in the middle of the Twister board." So I walk up to the window, and I open it up, and I'm like, "What?" And I see my older brothers and their friends sitting around a Twister board. And they're like, "Joey, come on downstairs, there's a hot dog gum in the middle of a Twister board." So I assume most of you guys know what a Twister board is. It's that, you know, sheet with the polka dots and you play Twister on it. And a hot dog gum is that, like, you know, individually wrapped little nickel candy that looks like a hot dog but tastes like gum. Not the opposite. And you got to realize, to a, you know, 5 or 6 year old, this hot dog gum is, you know, very exciting. But what's more exciting is that my older brothers wanted me, you know, to like play with them. These are like the neighborhood kids, you know, the older brothers, and you know, these are like real kids who like can skateboard and they can pop a wheelie and on a 10 speed, you know. These are real kids. Like, "I've got matches, let's blow something up." Real kids. And they wanted me because there was a hot dog gum in the middle of a Twister board. So I ran down the stairs and I knock open the screen door, and there they are surrounding the Twister board, and there's this hot dog gum right in the middle of the Twister board, and none of them are going for it. So I step out on the Twister board and I go for the gum, and they all stand up, and I fall in a pit. Like up, like the grass line up to my eyes. They had dug a pit under this Twister board. And now the biblical irony of being named Joseph and having your brothers drop you into a pit. Now that was not lost on my 5 or 6 year old self. So I made sure that I found that little hot dog gum and had that in my mouth before I let them pull me up out of the pit. So, you know, they lift me out and they're all cracking up and cracking wise and, you know, giving each other five and patting me on the back. And I went back upstairs and chewed my hot dog gum in my room. And I'll say this, a hot dog gum, the flavor lasts about 3 minutes tops. But the flavor of betrayal from your older brothers, that's a taste that lasts. Thank you.
That was Joey Garfield. Joey grew up in Evanston, Illinois, but moved to New York City to pursue a film career. It turns out the Twister Pit incident never truly left his mind. And a few years ago, he made a short film all about it. It's called Ex-Bully, and it premiered at the AFI Film Festival in Los Angeles. Joey's brother lives in L.A., so he invited him to come see it. And Joey says, "My brother clapped at the end, but he still hasn't apologized." For a link to Joey's film, head to themoth.org. Our next story is also about sibling games. Todd Kelly told this at a Story Slam in Portland, Oregon, where we partner with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Here's Todd, live at the mall.
When I was 7 years old, I came home from school one day, and my sister greeted me with her friends. And everybody has that one person in their life that they just want nothing but their approval because they hero worship them. And for me, it's always been my sister. And my sister greeted me with a Almond Joy bar and said, this is for you, and I need to tell you why it's for you. I was talking with all my friends today, and they were explaining how, like, all their little brothers and their little sisters, they're terrible people. And I thought, I'm so lucky, and I never treat you very well. And I realized how lucky I am that you're my brother, and I love you, and I bought this for you. And I was so thrilled. And I opened it, and I took a bite, and then I started. So here's what my sister did, real quick. My sister had bought an Almond Joy, and she'd steamed the package. She'd opened it. She'd pulled it out. She'd taken a bar of soap. She'd carved it in the shape of an Almond Joy. She'd melted chocolate over. She'd put it back. She'd glued it back and given it to me with this thing of sisterly love. And I am, like, going, oh, why did you do that? And my sister goes, because in this world there are winners and losers, and you are a loser. She didn't, like, this is 1970s. This is well before Mean Girls had L-finger-to-forehead technology, but I have this memory of her doing this. My sister is 5 years older than me, and there's nothing I can do. Fast forward real quick. I'm a freshman in college. She's in graduate school. By this point, we get along well. My sister and I, to this day, are unbelievably close. And we're home for break, and I make a list of 10 things that she's done to me in childhood that I'm going to repay her for. And later that night, we're having wine, and I tell her about the list, and she goes, well, that's fine. My guess is that, like, you'll probably get them all, maybe even this trip. But I'm telling you right now, you will never get me to eat chocolate-covered soap. And I'm like, I could. She goes, no, and this is why. Because I act with instinct. You overthink everything you ever do. And that's why I will always be 5 steps ahead of you. And that's why I beat you every time we go head to head. Challenge on. So for the next 10 years, I try so many ways. I actually made a salad with grated Parmesan cheese, and I grated soap into it as well. And it didn't matter what I did. One point I stopped for 3 years, knowing that in the fourth year I would do it again. And it didn't, and it wasn't like she wouldn't eat anything that I made. She'd eat it with gusto unless it had soap in it. It was just instinctively she knew. Two nights before my wedding, my in-laws, future in-laws, are coming into town. It's the night before the rehearsal dinner. My new sister-in-law explains to me that she's going to make this little dessert thing. They're like little fig things, and they're covered with chocolate. And it hits me. This is my chance. My sister won't see it coming from my sister-in-law. Who would do that? Nobody would do that. My sister won't see it coming. And my wife-to-be was like, do not do this. Partially because, like, we're a day and a half away from being married, and partially because her family is already a little worried that my family is really weird and crazy, which an idea that they've come up with through, observation. And she goes, you can't do this, honey. Just let me do this. I promise it won't get weird, and I promise it'll be fun. My sister will love it. And she goes, okay. Here's the thing. When your sister figures it out before she even eats it, you need to promise me you never do this again. That's it. And I promise. And so I help my sister-in-law, and I make this little fig thing with chocolate over. And then we have the dinner, and then it's dessert time, and some people are doing the dishes, and my sister-in-law's putting them on this platter. My parents have, like, this long porcelain platter, and we put them one in a row. And the thought is my sister-in-law will serve them first to my mom, then to my dad, then to my sister, then to my future mother-in-law. And by now, my sister-in-law, by the way, is getting cold feet. She's like, I don't know that this, I'm cool with this. I'm like, no, it's going to be fine. And she's like, well, your sister will find it amusing. I'm like, no, she will cry. It's going to be great. So I'm putting them on the thing, and I go, one for my mom, one for my dad, one for my sister, one. I'm like, no, my sister's going to know that the third one is soap. So I'm going to put the soap in the fourth one. So I put it down, and then I'm like, wait, hold on. My sister is going to know that I know that. And so my sister is going to go for the fourth. So I switch him back, and then I go, no, because my sister is only several steps ahead. My sister is going to know that I know that she knows. She'll never suspect it in the third. And so I keep switching. I am like Wallace Shawn in The Princess Bride, just back and forth between the third and the fourth. And finally, it just hits me that, like, I'm going to lose again. This is my one opportunity to ever win against my sister, and I am going to lose the way I always do. And then I remember what she had told me at this point 12 years ago, and I thought, I'm overthinking. You know, I'm just going to do instinct. I'm going to close my eyes, and I'm going to open them, and what would my sister do? And I'm going to put it there. I close my eyes, open, I put it there. Dessert comes, my sister-in-law, my mom takes one, pops it in her mouth. Dad takes one, puts it in her mouth, hands it over to my sister. My sister's about to go for the third, and she stops. And then she goes to the fourth, and then she stops, and then she looks at me. And then she gets this shit-eating grin on her face, and she slowly reaches all the way to the back, and then two down, and picks it up and pops it in her mouth. And then lets out a scream because that is where I had put the soap with the chocolate. And my sister screams and she gets up so fast that the chair falls back. And I am laughing maniacally and she's now chasing me around the table. And finally she grabs me by the shoulders and she takes me down like a steer. And she's just pounding on my chest going, and I am laughing and I see my in-laws and they are horrified. And my wife is so angry and I've got so much to make up for and I don't care because for this one moment, I'm the winner. Thank you.
That was Todd Kelly. Todd is a writer who has embedded himself in bizarre and extreme subcultures in America, Klan rallies, exorcism camps, and professional cuddling conventions. He's also the creator of the storytelling and live music show Seven Deadly Sins in Portland, Oregon, where he lives with his wife and two sons. And his wife has asked Todd not to teach the kids about hijinks like this. It turns out the soap was actually the last prank that he and his sister played on one another. After that, he says, anything more would be a letdown. To see two photos of Todd and his sister, each taken the year they got the other to eat soap, go to themoth.org. After our break, a story of learning to run and a competitive Latin club when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from the University of Kansas. transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu. Tonight on Live at Green Lady Lounge, it's the Danny Embry Trio. Danny's one of KC's finest guitarists, and we'll hear his trio perform an hour of original tunes. Join us for Live at Green Lady Lounge, tonight at 6, here on Kansas Public Radio. Clear skies, tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a low of 49 degrees. Sunny for tomorrow with a high of 80, a low in the mid-50s for Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin-Ginez. We're exploring competition and sport in this hour. And weirdly, we also have a sub-theme of candy and chocolate, as you'll note. Our next story is also about wanting to win. Wanting to win at all costs when you're in the high school Latin club and competing against college kids. Romy Negrin told this story at the Bell House in Brooklyn at our first showcase of the Moth's high school education program. Here's Romy.
Hello. So at my school, there are some kids who take Latin. We call them losers. And some of those kids have gone the extra mile and joined the competitive Latin team. We call them pathetic losers. And I am one such pathetic loser. I started taking Latin in seventh grade. I was like, oh, it'll be fun and ancient, whatever. And everyone I knew was like, don't take Latin. It's a dead language. Who are you going to speak to in Latin? The Pope? Someday. But I started taking Latin, and I fell in love with it. Aww. And at the beginning of eighth grade, my Latin teacher was like, hey, you should join Curtamen, the competitive Latin team. Curtamen, for those of you who don't know, means competition in Latin, because you go to competitions to do Latin. And I was like, sure. So I joined the Curtamen team, and it's me and three other kids in the novice team, and we start practicing for the first big competition of the year, Yale. They have these competitions at all the big universities, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, you know, where you expect this sort of thing to be. And we start practicing, and the big day finally arrives. And we gather at Grand Central at like 5:30 in the morning, too early. But we don't care because in New Haven, Connecticut. What a town. So we get on the train, and one of my friends has brought along this ball of chocolate. This big, huge for chocolate, wrapped in the shiniest tinfoil you ever did see. And we agreed as a team that we would eat that chocolate if and only if we made it to semifinals. So that's an extra incentive other than the fact that I'm inherently competitive by nature and there's glory in victory. So we're on the train and we're practicing, we're conjugating our verbs like porto, portas, portat, portamus, portatus, portat. And we're singing our song, row, row, row your emperors. And my Latin teacher's just there and she's like, yay, we're all gonna have fun. And I was like, yeah, winning would be fun. And we finally arrive at Yale. And every competition starts off with a lecture where they bring in one of the classics faculty to like give us a talk about Roman pottery to get us into the competition mood. That's like the start of the day. And then they ask you questions about Roman history, mythology, Latin vocabulary, grammar, literature, basically like everything. And so we go to the lecture, and after the lecture, they tell us that they've pioneered this fun new system, a bracket system, where for each division, novice, intermediate, and advanced, there will be two brackets, an A bracket for people who have been to a Curtamen before, and a B bracket for people who had no idea what they were doing. And we clearly belonged in the B bracket because we'd never done it before. And we were like, off we go to the B bracket. But the B bracket would only send one team to semifinals, while the A bracket would send eight teams to semifinals. Yeah. You can all do math. After the lecture, they say, hold on a minute. One of the teams from the A bracket isn't here. Would one of the teams from the B bracket like to join the A bracket? And we looked at each other and we were like, eight is greater than one. So we were like, we will join the A bracket, please. So we switch and we're like high-fiving ourselves about this decision that we've made. And we skip along off to our first round where we meet our first challengers. Acton Boxborough. Acton Boxborough is the name of their school. Just think about that. Five syllables. So many syllables. You know it has to be pretentious. And they were. Their team was comprised of a junior and a senior in the novice division. And we're in eighth grade. And the senior is flirting with the moderator. Because the moderator is just like a sophomore at Yale. So, yeah. So he's like, who's your favorite Roman poet? And she's like, I like Ovid. And he's like, Ovid? I love Ovid. And I'm just looking at my friends like, Ovid? I've never read Ovid. I'm still stuck on book two of the Cambridge Latin course. A great read if you ever have the chance. So that's round one, but we actually do pretty well in round one. So round two, our fiercest competitors yet, Oak Hall. Only two syllables, but one of the syllables is Hall. So just contemplate that. And they're buzzing in before the questions are finished. It's like, in what year did the emperor... 123 A.D. What's the ablative singular form of... Pane. And it's like, how did they know? And the reason they know is because they have a coach, Adam. And Adam, he ties his long hair back in a ponytail, and he wears this flannel, and he stares those children dead in the eyes. And God forbid they should get a question wrong, because then Adam has something to say about it. He goes, excuse me, but actually, in Virgil's Aeneid, book 1, line 324, he uses the alternative poetic form of the word, which is the form that Keegan answered with. Keegan is your name if you go to Oak Hall, I guess. So Keegan deserves to be awarded those points. And what is this moderator going to do? She's like 19 and it's the middle of a Saturday afternoon. So she's just like, yeah, I guess. So Oak Hall thrashes us. But the preliminaries end and we actually feel pretty good about our score. And we're like looking at each other and we're like, we think we're going to make it to semis. And we're looking at our chocolate and we're like, we're going to eat you. And we're just waiting for them to post the scores. And we're waiting and we're waiting and we're like, eighth place or better, eighth place or better, eighth place or better. And they post the scores. And we were in ninth place. I know! I know! And the worst part is we looked at our score and we looked at the top score from the B bracket. And, yeah, you can guess. Our score was higher than the top score in the B bracket. So had we remained in the B bracket, we would have advanced to semifinals. Ugh. And my Latin teacher is like, ninth out of 18. That's pretty good. Let's get back on the train. And we're like, not good enough. And we're looking at each other, and we're looking at that chocolate, and we're like, oh, we didn't deserve this chocolate. But I'll be damned if we didn't eat it anyway. And we swore that next time, we would earn it. Thank you.
That was Romy Negru. Romy told the story when she was a senior in high school. She refers to herself as a denizen of New York and the best friend of her cat, Edith. She named this story Dulce et Decorum, which translates to It is Sweet and Right. Romy says she's a prolific reader, a mediocre baker, and a terrible athlete. Kertamans are run by college classics clubs, and Romy would love nothing more than to organize one of these competitions of her own someday. To see photos of Romy from the Latin Club Kertaman in this story, go to themoth.org. Next in this hour, a story from the running club. Tamin Ola told this in one of the Moth's college workshops at the City University of New York. Here's Tamin live at the Moth.
Hi, everyone. So, since I was a little girl, I always wanted to be strong. The idea of having muscles was just amazing to me, and a lot of the women in my family were like, whoa, you're crazy. But I was always suppressed from my dreams because where I'm from, girls are raised to be married and not really have an education. But my mother, she always wanted me to have an education and also get married too, but education first, but I don't really care about marriage at all, to be honest. Not just that, but my mom also had like a dress code. She taught me to always cover up, and I didn't really always like that. It never fit for me. So I've always been kept indoors. I never had the freedom as a kid to go outside and play in the park like most kids do. My mom just gets scared that maybe I'll get lost or something. But anyways, I had an idea in my head like when I was like 13. Like, I want to do a sport. I want to be athletic. But will my mom allow that? No, she would not. No, she would not. She would say things like, you know, men are going to look at you when you're running around and like you're wearing shorts. And hearing those things always really hurt my heart because I strongly believe that she is wrong. But she strongly believes that she is right. So one day I'm at Hunter and I'm at the athletic room and I see pictures of strong athletic women like sweating and they look determined and they look exhausted, but they look like I have to do this. And I see these women and I know that is me. This is like, it's my third year in college. And I thought to myself, I kept myself inside for way too long. I have to do something that makes me who I am because I'm tired of not being me. So I joined track. And I kept it a secret for a while. In the beginning, it was brutal. Every single day, I felt like I was dying. I was always the last girl to finish the race. And like my coach would yell like, oh, for this girl, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And then when I'm coming in, he would yell 5 minutes. And then and I'm like exhausted. But all the other girls on the team pat me on the back because they know that I just started and this is new and it's hard. So one day I'm coming home from track and I'm passing by my mom's room and she calls me over. My mom, she's sitting on her bed and she looks pretty tired and calm. And she makes me sit down on the bed and she asks me, like, are you doing track? My stomach turned and I just decided to tell her the truth because I didn't want to hide anymore. I'm tired of hiding. And I said, yes. And there was like a really long pause. She wouldn't even look at me in the face. And she said, "You're going down the wrong path." I could have argued with her like I've argued with her my whole life. But I knew that she will stick with her beliefs just as much as I will stick with mine's, and I just left the room. So whenever I go to practice, I would always remember that my mom doesn't want me here. And then I would question, why am I here? Why am I putting myself through all this pain? Why go and do this and feel like I'm going to throw up after a run and be last and suck too? But every time I finish a race, I feel good about myself. I feel stronger every day. I can feel my legs getting stronger. I would run just 4 blocks and I would get exhausted, but then I'd push myself to go, okay, go 1 mile, now go 2 miles, now double that, try it. And like the longest I ever did was 6, and I'm just so amazed at myself. Whenever I'm running and I feel like maybe I should stop halfway because I can't do it, I tell myself, no, don't insult yourself like that. You can do it. And then I would hear all the voices of the people that I love, and they would say, like, go, Tamin, go. You're almost finishing this. And like, finish strong. Always finish strong. I have people in my life that's waiting for me at the finish line, waiting to hug me, and that's why I do it. I'm never going to stop. I'm always going to fight because I want to love myself. And it doesn't matter how slow or how fast you are, as long as you finish the race. Thank you.
Tamin Ola is a graduate of Hunter College, where she studied human biology. And to find out more about our high school and college workshops, you can go to themoth.org. After our break, our final story, an inventive and almost disastrous marriage proposal, when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online, kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for the Moth Radio Hour here on a Saturday evening. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris will meet in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate Tuesday night. It's the second presidential debate of this election season, taking place in a dramatically different race for the White House. KPR and NPR will bring you live coverage of the debate Tuesday night at 8 p.m. here on Kansas Public Radio. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, clear skies, a low of 49 degrees. Sunny for tomorrow with a high of 80. Sunday night sky is clear with lows in the mid-50s, and on Monday sunny with a high of 85. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
You're listening to the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse. The last story in this hour about winning and losing is from Abhishek Shah. Abhishek told us in Alaska, where we partnered with the Anchorage Concert Association. Here's Abhishek live at the Moth.
Wow. Hello, everyone. A couple of years back, I went to India to visit my family. And during that time, I remember I went to this nightclub and I saw this beautiful girl. And I was looking at her, and I kept looking at her, and then she looked somewhere else, and then she looked at me, and then I looked somewhere else. And then we both looked at each other, and we fell in love at the third sight. A year later, we were dating, you know, we had now decided that we wanted to get married. But see, our relationship was modern in a sense that it was a love marriage, but it was still traditional in a sense that we wanted to get the blessings of our parents and approvals of our parents. Otherwise, we had decided that we will not get married. So first I introduced my girlfriend to my parents, and my parents loved her, and she loved my parents. It was amazing. Now it was my turn to meet her parents. And I didn't know how this was going to go, because my girlfriend had warned me that her dad's personality is exactly opposite as mine. I was a little bit concerned. I was like, I don't know. I have to create this good first impression, you know, in order to make sure that he likes me. So the next day, they invited me over for the dinner at my girlfriend's house. I was like, you know what? I'm going to create a very good first impression. But I reach at their house like 2 hours late because there was a lot of traffic. And when I reached there, he was like hardly talking to me. So I was trying to diffuse the tension. So I kind of tried to do like a fist pump. But he didn't react. So I just did a fist bump by myself. And everything that night I tried to do, it just didn't work. So I was like, you know what, I have to keep trying in order to impress their parents. Like the next day, I told my girlfriend to switch off the internet. And then I went to her house and I fixed the internet. It didn't work out. Her dad realized that all I did was put the adapter back in socket. So I was like, you know, I'll keep trying. Like the next day, I know that her girlfriend likes to go for running every morning, like for health reasons. So I just kind of joined, you know, just to do like an informal conversation. I even tried to crack a joke. I was like, oh, even you go for running every... Even I go for running every day to the restroom. When I eat a lot of spicy food. He didn't like the joke. He didn't. So everything I kept trying, it kept getting worse and worse. I was like, you know, I need to do something very quick because I had to come back to the United States and I was getting a little desperate. So at that time, I realized there was this one friend of mine who had helped someone in a similar situation. So I called him. I was like, you know, I need your help. Can you help me? Now, this friend of mine, he was a big Bollywood fan. Like everything he would do is over the top, nonsense, won't even make sense. Like he would do everything over the top. So I called him. I was like, you know, let's meet. He met me. I was like, you know, what can I do? Can you help me? And he was like, bro, I got this, bro. I got this. This is what we are going to do, okay? You meet your girlfriend with her parents, and then I will come and snatch the purse of your girlfriend. And then I will run and you follow me. And then you bring the purse back and her parents would think you are the hero. I'm like, what? That's a terrible plan. He was like, bro, It's 100% guaranteed success. If you follow this plan, you will be good for the rest of your life. I was like, I don't know. I wasn't very sure with the whole plan. But then I told my girlfriend, and she was like, really? You are going to impress my parents with fake mugging? I was like, yes, that's exactly how this is going to work out. So we both weren't sure whether this would work or not, but we also knew that we were running out of ideas to impress her dad. So I was like, you know, we'll go ahead with the plan. So we decided, like the next day, it was her mom's birthday, and they go to a fixed restaurant, like this very beautiful restaurant every year. And I was like, that's the restaurant where we'll execute our plan. So I told my Bollywood friend that this is the restaurant, this is the table, there's a table in the corner, and you come there and you do your thing, and be there at 8 p.m. So the day comes, next day, I reach to a restaurant like 2 hours before, and I'm nervous, I'm like a nervous wreck, I'm sweating, I have like thousands of thoughts, like what if this doesn't work, what would happen if it works, like what's going on? And I was just very nervous. I was pacing back and forth. It was like then 7 p.m., 7:15, 7:30. And as the time was coming close to 8 p.m., I was trying to call my Bollywood friend just to make sure that the plan is still on. But he wasn't responding. Like his phone was going directly to voice message. He wasn't responding to my text messages. So I was like, you know, I was just getting more and more nervous. And then my girlfriend and her parents came, and we sat down for the dinner. It was almost like half an hour, like 8:30, and I still didn't hear anything from my friend. So I was like, you know what, maybe he just backed out of the plan. Maybe he doesn't want to do this anymore. And just around 8:30, I see a stranger person walking towards our table, and he snatches the purse and he starts running. I'm like, who is that guy? He wasn't even part of our plan. What is, like, I'm confused. My girlfriend is confused. And it's all happening so fast. I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I just stood up and started running after that stranger. And he just disappeared. He dropped the purse somewhere in the corner. So I took the purse. I came back to her table. And I told her parents I took care of him. And at that time, like, her girlfriend's dad was so happy and relieved to see that, you know, I was okay. And for the first time, I saw him smiling. And I remember I wasn't even eating a dessert, but it tasted like a sweet $1 million. I was like, you know what, this wasn't part of our plan, but it just worked out in our favor. So I was like very happy. And just when we were about to finish our dinner, my Bollywood friend shows up. And now, I don't know what to do. Like, I cannot say anything. So I'm trying to express with my eyes, like, don't do anything. I've already proved that I'm a man. But my Bollywood friend, he has an IQ of minus infinity. So he just ignores the whole telepathy thing and just goes and grabs the purse. But before I could do anything, my girlfriend's father jumped on him. And he started punching him. And just at that time, this is what my friend says, "Abhishek, help me." I'm like, I don't know you. And then he goes on, he's like, "Oh, I was late, my phone was switched off. So I sent one of my other friends to take care of this thing." I'm like, "What? What a great time to bring that up." And we were just disappointed. Like, I was extremely disappointed. My girlfriend was extremely disappointed. And just when I reached home, I was thinking, where did I go wrong? Everything was a mess. Everyone was disappointed. And I was just thinking that, you know, what I did wasn't very good. So I just opened my laptop and I sent her dad an email that, you know, whatever I did today, I'm extremely sorry. I know it's not the right thing, but my intention were not bad. And if there's any person whom I'll ever get married to, it would be your daughter, and this is 100% honest here. And then I closed my laptop. I was just awake the whole night. I couldn't sleep, and there was nothing from their side. And then the next day, I got a call from her dad, and he told me to bring me and my family, all, they invited us over the lunch. We went to their place, and I was like, I don't know how this is going to work out. And then her dad told me that, you know, it's not that you are a bad person, we know you are a good person, but to send my daughter all the way to a new country, you know, to move all the way to a new country is an extremely huge decision for us. But if she does move, then it would be only with you. And then I tried to do like a fist bump. And this time, he did give me a fist bump. Now we are done. Thank you.
That was Abhishek Shah. Abhishek works as a biomedical engineer, and even with a few missteps, he won in the end. He and his wife, Fennal, have been married for years now and live in California with their two kids. Abhishek never spoke to his Bollywood friend after this, but he has a great relationship with his in-laws, and yes, his father-in-law still makes fun of his botched proposal whenever they're together. And for anyone out there considering a proposal, Abhishek says, if you're trying to make a good impression with your could-be in-laws, be honest, keep it simple, and don't act in desperation. It makes things messy. I asked Abhishek if there were any photos from the night of his mother-in-law's birthday, and he said no.
But to see photos from his wedding with all the family and 1,500 guests all looking very happy, go to themoth.org. And The Moth is all about true stories, so our fact-checking team, in this case me, called up Abhishek's wife, Finale. Hi, Finale. I've been wanting to chat with you for so long.
Same here. Hi, Sarah.
So I had to call and ask you, did this really happen?
Yeah, actually, yeah. It happened and it's unbelievable. I told him that it's really not a good plan. Let's not do this. But he is like, you know what? We are running short of time and we can do this. Trust me, it will be fine.
I loved seeing the photographs of your wedding that he sent.
It's the best wedding ever. Like, we had like 1,400 to 1,500 people in our wedding. Yeah, it was like a one week of celebration.
That was Finale Shah. Remember, you can share these stories or others from the Moth Archive through our website, themoth.org. Find us on social media, too. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at The Moth. In the end, it's not really about winners or losers. It's the story of how you play the game, right? That's it for this episode of The Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time.
This hour with Sarah Austin Jeunesse. Sarah also directed the stories in the show along with Catherine McCarthy, with additional coaching in the high school program by Michaela Bly. The rest of the Moss directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Emily Couch. Moss stories are true as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Medeski, Martin, and Wood, Cormac, Penguin Cafe Orchestra, Blue Dot Sessions, and Jerry Douglas and VM Bot. You can find links to all the music we use at our website. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching us your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
Support for the Moth Radio Hour on KPR comes from Cromwell Solar. Since 1982, installing independent energy systems, such as backup batteries and solar panels for farms, homes, and businesses. More information is at cromwellsolar.com. And the Midwest Trust Center at JCCC, presenting Malevo Live, an all-male group specializing in Malimbo, a traditional Argentine folk dance, Thursday, September 26th, 7:30 p.m. Details at jccc.edu/mtc. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute, and online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Welcome to Green Lady Lounge, located at 1809 Grand Boulevard in downtown Kansas City. I'm Daryl Brogdon. The Green Lady is the home of Kansas City Jazz, featuring live performances 365 days a year. On this day, we'll be hearing from one of Kansas City's finest guitarists, Danny Embry. He's joined today by bassist Gerald Spates and drummer Brian Stever. It's the Danny Embry Trio, live at the Green Lady Lounge.
Thank you.